All right, ladies and gentlemen, back today. We're talking with somebody. We're going to be talking about some pretty dark and messed up stuff. We're going to be talking about ecology and microplastics. We've got Dr. Danielle Green, associate professor down there at Anglia Ruskin University. How was that?
Perfect. Thanks very much.
So you hail from Australia, lived in Ireland, and then settled on the UK. What drove you to ecology? How did you get in love with the earth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Basically, when I was a child, I grew up in the Blue Mountains in Australia, which is the bit that we had millions of hectares burn a couple of years ago. So it's kind of, you know, quite a well-known part of Australia now because of the bushfires. I grew up there, but we would go to the ocean maybe once or twice a year. And it was always a really big, important event for me going to the ocean. And I fell in love with marine life and the ocean and everything about it because it was such a special thing to go there because it was like a, you know, kind of a four-hour drive away. And we just didn't really have much money growing up. So it was like this, the best kind of time of year to go to the sea. And so I decided that I wanted to study marine life and I wanted to try to conserve and help save, you know, sharks. It started with sharks because I saw a documentary about shark finning. But it's pretty much the whole thing, the whole ecosystem really. So, yeah.
As you went along, did you realize that there is not, I mean, the sharks are the ones that we all know about, but there's sea creatures that we don't even know about that are being exploited and hurt by human beings, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you start off, you know, seeing documentaries and you think, oh, that's really cool and that's really sad. And it's usually the big charismatic megafauna. It's things like sharks and whales. But then the more that you get into it, you have to conserve the habitat, you know, and you have to conserve the actual habitat itself and all the creatures to save those ones at the top of the food chain. And yeah, we're discovering new species in the deep sea. And there's probably a lot of things that have already gone extinct that we've never even discovered. Which is quite a sad thought.
never knew that they existed. There was some kind of wonderful, magical giant squid or Loch Ness.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the tragedy of our times is seeing all our existence encroaching upon the existence of innocent, you know, simple animals that are just trying to live within their means. But so the other thing is that's coming along, you've researched about is microplastics, and your research has shown that microplastics pollution in the Falklands is as high as in the UK. So first, take me, how was the Falklands, first of all?
Amazing. So yeah, I got to go to the Falklands in 2015, and I got to sample around the whole of the, hang on, I always get my directions mixed up, west, east, the whole of the East Island, which is where most people live. It's a very unpopulated place. It was incredible because we actually flew to Ascension Island first, which is just this tiny, it's one of the most remote islands in the world. It's across from Argentina. And it's like, there's just two military bases there, a British one and a US one. And nobody officially lives there. You can't be resident there. So it's a lot of researchers and military operations that go on and you kind of pass through. And most people aren't allowed outside the airport, which the airport is just like a chicken wire fence. It's tiny. You're inside this little pen. But I had a permit, so I was allowed to go and explore Ascension Island. And we sampled there as well, actually. So we got a boat and we went around the whole of that island, which didn't take long because it's small, and sampled for microplastics. And we saw flying fish, which was incredible. And there were dolphins everywhere and saw a yellowfin tuna breach and just really, really cool place, but also full of microplastics. And then, yeah, we went to the Falklands after that and sampled different parts of it, including some really remote little islands off the Falklands. And it was quite surprising. Yeah. So I sampled around the UK and Portugal and other places, and the concentrations were very, very similar. So it's not dependent on human population because these places have very small local populations, right? So this means that some of the plastics are coming via the ocean currents and from other sources, which was interesting. So yeah, it wasn't entirely surprising, but I didn't expect it to be as high. Hmm. Yeah.
Does that match up with other studies that you hear about as far as where they're finding microplastics? Are they finding them in like you know, remote locations like that?
Yeah, it does match up. Yeah, and there's been other studies done since around the same sort of area that corroborate the findings that I found as well. They're also finding high amounts, you know, top of Mount Everest, the Arctic, the marine systems around the Arctic. All these places are full of microplastics. It's much more rare to hear, oh, we didn't find microplastics. I mean, if someone could come to, oh, this is somewhere I didn't find microplastics, I would be really surprised because they seem to be, you know, everywhere. So it does seem to be common. Yeah.
And when you went to the Falklands, what kind of samples were you taking, and where were you taking them from? And then what did that tell you about the biodiversity of the, or what it was doing to the biodiversity there?
Yeah, so we were the first to sample in the Falklands, and on Ascension as well, I think. And so we didn't have really fancy equipment. We just literally just took glass bottles, obviously, because you don't want to contaminate with plastic of water. Now, that is a common thing. That is a thing that happens. And then obviously you end up, oh, we've got loads of milk bottle plastic particles. And it's like, yeah, because you're using a milk bottle to sample. You know, these things do happen. You have to make sure you use something else.
All the microplastics over there, maybe it came from, researchers going over there.
The researchers. No, it's a serious issue. You do have to think about your methods. So we used glass bottles. The funny thing was, though, on Ascension Island, we couldn't get sample bottles, like proper glass bottles there at the time. And because it's so remote and they ship everything over, we had to use 1 liter gin bottles. So we didn't drink all the gin. Other people, we drink a little bit of it, but so those were what we, because you only get big bottles of alcohol there. They don't seem to do small measures. And there's no tax
to do over there. So
it's well, yeah, this, and it's all military people, right? So it's kind of, it's quite a, yeah. So anyway, so we ended up collecting all these like gin bottles, big 1 liter gin bottles, and we clean those out and we use those to sample. So we were taking water that was about, kind of about fairly shallow, like pretty close to the coast. So it was about maybe 1 meter deep, that sort of thing. I can't remember exactly now. Hmm. Surface water. Yeah. So that you can sample from different parts of the water column. So you can either do like the surface, in the middle of it, or all the way down the bottom. It depends what equipment you've got with you.
Uh-huh. And all are, the more samples you take, the better, obviously. So what did what are the implications of what it does to the, wildlife and stuff like this?
Yeah. So with the Falklands and places like that, there's still very few studies done on interactions of plastic with the wildlife there. But there is a study that looked at the seabirds and what kind of plastic that they were eating. There's these birds called, are they turkey vultures, I think they're called? Yeah, they're not pretty, but they're really big and they're really important for the ecosystem because of, they eat kind of like waste, they're cleanup crew, right?
Yeah.
So they're really important. And they're everywhere. They're quite a big bird, and they just look at you like, yeah, just try it. I mean, the birds there, you just don't mess with the birds in the Falkland. They're incredible. There's so many of these big birds that just follow you around. It's really interesting. But anyway, there's a researcher there, and she looked at their droppings and also their vomit. So they
good work if you can get it.
And she found quite a lot of plastic. I think it was like, 16% by weight of what they were eating was plastic, which that is a lot if you think about, think about your own diet in a day and imagine 16% of it was plastic by weight. That is a lot. A lot of that was because they were feeding on the landfill sites, which are open air. So you can, they just kind of peck around there. And there was another study that looked at the fish around the South Atlantic, so Falklands, Ascension Island, and a lot of the fish have got microplastics in them as well. It's difficult to tell what impact it's having, though, because these things aren't well studied anyway. You'd need to kind of monitor over time, and there's just not enough research looking at that. But
and this is this might be outside your wheelhouse too, but what have you heard about the effects on living creatures, like animals specifically, fish and birds and stuff? What are they saying? Because I've heard some things. What have you heard about what microplastics do to the insides?
Yeah, I mean, so that is one thing that I have worked on, not particularly in the Falklands, but in other places. I've done a lot of experiments on impacts of microplastics, and it can affect their organisms' feeding rates, their reproductive rates. So that's an important one, because microplastics won't kill an organism outright. Okay, so it's not like you get entangled in a plastic bag and you choke to death or something like that. It's more of a slow burn effect. It's a legacy pollutant, so the effects are going to last, you know, into the coming populations. So if you get a reduction in reproductive rates and reproductive success, then the population in the future is affected, because there's going to be fewer of them, right? Yeah. They're going to be less healthy as well. So there's those sorts of effects that are the most worrying. But if even things like, so bivalves, for example, oysters, mussels, that kind of thing, these are filter feeders, right? Now, they clean the water. That they're really important ecosystem engineers. You know, they clean the water. They keep it nice and clean. They improve clarity to increase the plant growth, you know, or algal growth in the water. They do a lot, and they're really important. If their rate of feeding or filtering is reduced, then that could have really important knock-on effects, because they're not doing their job as ecosystem engineers as well. So those are some of the important ecological effects. There's also, you know, just losing energy, because if you're ingesting stuff that isn't digestible, so if half of everything that you eat is plastic and it comes out the other end, that means you're getting half the amount of food that you think you're getting. Could be a good way to lose weight. They might take off, but you know, it's not ideal if you're an organism just trying to survive in the oceans, and you can't get sufficient food. So in terms of like energy, you might be kind of losing health, and that could eventually lead to premature death. But it's not like a quick, you know, an instant death type thing.
Yeah. Oh my God. Now I just turned my whole day around. Now I'm sad. But what about? There's also some. Studies are saying that these are endocrine disrupting as well, and that there's a lot of reproductive interference and stuff like this. What have you heard about that?
Yeah, so that's across, you know, that's not just the bivalves and invertebrates. That they think that's also happening because of the plasticizer, the chemicals, basically. Mm. So, you know, plastics, they are made of chemicals. They are chemicals. They're, you know, parts of them are inert because they're a solid, but they do leach toxins, they leach chemicals. They also absorb chemicals from the water around them and then leach those back out. Mm-hmm. So there's two different ways they can leach chemicals. And there's quite a lot of evidence that certain persistent chemicals, which are plastic derived, can affect the endocrine system, can be endocrine disruptors of things like, even things like whales and dolphins and, you know, the big charismatic stuff that everyone cares about, all the way down to the invertebrates. So that's something that, once again, it's more difficult to prove because we can't do an experiment on a whale. You know, you're not going to get permission to to dose them. But so it's difficult because then, you know, how do we know it's because of that? It might be other things, but it correlates with the whales being full of plastic, right? So there's a very good chance that all this stuff that's leaching out of that plastic is having that effect. So we're finding increased concentrations of these nasty chemicals in the whale's tissue.
Oh my.
So that, you know, it's a fairly strong evidence. It's kind of, you'll always get debate about these things, which is important, but it's pretty strong evidence.
I put my money on the fact that this is probably most likely the biggest catastrophe, you know, humans have ever taken part in. I mean, we've done some pretty horrible stuff, but, and it all comes back to the petrochemicals, right? And it comes back from pulling oil out of the ground and trying to figure out something to do with it. And it ended up being a bad idea. So you did a paper, Effects of Microplastics in Soil Ecosystems Above and Below Ground. Let's talk about soil. What are the effects that it's having on soil, and what was it like studying it?
Yeah, so that was led by a collaborator who's a soil scientist, but I mean, I was very much involved in the work too. There's a little bit of a different system to the oceans, but similar effects in many ways. So basically, in soil, we found the microplastics are actually changing the structure of the soil. So if you think about, if you kind of shrink your brain, you know, shrink your kind of sight down, we've gone from big organisms like whales all the way down to microbes. Think about individual grains of soil, of sand and silt. It actually changes the structure of it. So you end up with different sized aggregates. Now, aggregates are clumps of grains together. Now, that can have an effect because it affects the way that organisms move through the soil. So if you've got lots of really big grains clumped around, then you need a big organism to move through it. things like that. It can kind of change the way that, they move. The other thing it changes, it can be pH, so the, you know, the different chemical conditions of the soil as well. Those changes can impact the microbes. Now, everything in the world is comes down to the small stuff we can't see. The whole world, the functioning of the whole ecosystem, the whole planet is really dependent on microbes. They're the unsung hero. I wrote a poem once about microbes, Ode to a Microbe. I won't talk to you.
I like you. I knew I would.
But they are like, they are really important. So if you're changing the microbes, then everything further up the food web is also going to be affected. So it's a cascading effect. It's difficult because a lot of the studies were done in pots, including ours actually. So scaling that up. So we found that plant growth was affected. You're not getting as much of the plant in terms of biomass. The germination of the seeds was affected, which obviously population level effect again. But it's also, there was a couple of field studies, and we're running one at the moment for a PhD student, and we're seeing similar effects in like a real situation, so not just in pots in a greenhouse. So that's, you know, because I was sort of thinking, oh, well, maybe it's only in a controlled condition. Maybe actually out in the field it doesn't have an effect, but it looks like it's the same thing.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Which is interesting, but not necessarily great.
No. Every discovery you could possibly make on this is not necessarily uplifting, right?
No, I mean, it's really interesting from an academic point of view. We like writing about it because that's what we do. But from a implications for the planet point of view, you know, not so great.
How do you keep your hat on straight? Like, how do you keep from going under a cloud of depression, knowing that there's so many things that we've kind of screwed up as humans.
Yeah, I mean, it can be depressing as a scientist working in any sort of conservation field. What I do is in my spare time, I do work for the United Nations Environment Programme. And, you know, I'm part of the group, because there are hundreds of us working to bring in the Global Plastics Treaty that has come in recently. Now, that's not like that comes in and everything's fixed. That's taking years of negotiation with the plastics industry and with governments across, you know, 175 countries to make sure that we can do something that helps. So that keeps me going because it's like we actually have made progress here. And other issues like climate change, people have just been denying it for so long that, you know, I feel like with plastic, everyone can see it's a problem because we all use it and it's visible. Climate change, we're all contributing to climate change, but we don't kind of see it as clearly. So plastic's not the worst in terms of making you depressed, because I think most people care about it. And that helps me to, you know, that's how I get through, basically.
Yeah, I do gin, so yeah. That helps me through the, God. Yeah, but I mean, so, what do you think of being somebody who has their hands on the wheel and is active in this UN thing? And so you have this power. For a lot of us, we are powerless. But what can individuals do to sort of, I mean, this is a no-brainer, but maybe from an expert it sounds good. What steps can individuals take on limiting their microplastic pollution?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's single-use plastics are the real problem. You know, I'm not necessarily, your headset is plastic, right? But you're going to use that for a while. You're not chucking that out today and using another one. You know,
I told you that. Everything like
this shirt is plastic. You know, we're all using plastic, right? But it's the single-use items that are the problem, and they're about 40% of all plastic production is for single-use items. So that's a big chunk.
Wow.
So do we need everything to be single-use? Now, some things, yeah. Some things we're not going to get rid of, but there's certain things that either lobbying, you know, signing petitions to governments when they come around instead of just sort of ignoring it. You know, these things come on social media. It is important that people sign those things because the more support from everybody, then the governments have to do something about it, right? And I'm sure that's true in most countries, every country, but that definitely is true in, like, you know, America and the United Kingdom, places like that. But, you know, they have to respond if you get over a certain number of people signing things. So I think that's a way that you can be part of the solution, is saying, well, actually, I don't want, and actually just, you know, trolling supermarkets when they have, not just supermarkets, but places that use a lot of single-use plastic. If you're a consumer, you can say, well, hang on a minute, I don't want all this single-use plastic. And a lot of the changes that supermarkets brought in, it wasn't because of scientists like me and people writing legislation. And, you know, it was actually people on Twitter going, shaming the supermarkets for using, I can't remember what the hashtag was. Oh, pointless plastics was the hashtag.
Nice.
Those sorts of things, they actually do have an impact, because then the supermarkets want customers.
Yeah.
They have to care, because it's all marketing. And, oh, we have to be green and sustainable. Now, there's a lot of greenwashing, but if they're using fewer single-use plastics, then that, you know, that's good. That's a genuine outcome that is good.
It's a horrible truth about the free market capitalist hellhole we live in, is that we are in charge of... We have to be savvy consumers to the extent where we have to tell the stores what they should be doing. But in the same time, they're going to keep lying and manipulating and doing whatever makes the money and is the easiest thing.
Yeah.
So it's like a full on.
And you do wonder what goes on behind the scenes, because I know there was a bit of a scandal with, oh yeah, we've got fewer plastics, but they were just unwrapping them all backstage in the packing room before things were coming out. So then they were chucking out the same, you know, there's things like that. So you, for every good thing, there's so many little kind of tweaks and steps you have to go back and make sure it is genuine and fact check everything before you get too excited. It's quite cynical these days.
Yeah.
But I still think there are some positive, you know, you've got to keep yourself going.
Yeah. Well, positives. I'm going to keep the fight going. I'm education and like just constantly being annoying to people on Twitter until people start understanding this new paradigm that we're in, because we have to think of these things differently now. It's just, we're trapped. We're trapped in an elevator with one guy farted and it's just stinking up and we're all going to die soon. Whereas it's like, you know, pissing in the well, essentially.
Yeah.
And we've been doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
So is there any other, like, obviously microplastics is huge and you've been focused on it. Are there any other, you know, existential kind of ecological crisis that we should be looking forward to soon?
Well, I mean, one that we're working on at the moment is disposable vapes, which kind of links back to single use. I mean, this is a single use electronic item, which is the most unsustainable, ridiculous thing you could ever invent. So the funny thing was, we started off with these being reusable and as a smoking cessation tool, so to stop people smoking, great, no problem with that. But now we've got a whole generation of young people hooked on nicotine that probably never would have smoked. So, and the issue that, you know, as environmentalists, okay, human health, of course I care about it, but it's not my area of expertise. But from an environmental point of view, why have them disposable? You know, we don't need them to be disposable. If people want a vape, you can get the reusable ones. But these are really getting popular in different, you know, there's talk about trying to ban them, but governments often lack backbone when it comes to actually banning things. But I mean, yeah, I think if you do vape, yeah, apparently it's better for your health than smoking. So that's fine. But, you know, use the reusable ones if you can, unless you've got some sort of medical condition where you can't refill it or something, you know, I'm sure there's reasons people have to use disposable ones, but please only do it if you absolutely need to.
Not just because they can be. What reasons would you need a disposable thing? It just doesn't make any sense.
The vape industry has a couple of reasons up its sleeve. If you have a look on Twitter, there's always an answer for everything. Yeah. Okay. And it's kind of like, okay, you know, and there might be, that's fine. But the majority of people don't need to use disposable vapes. You've got a rechargeable battery in these things. It's rechargeable. It's lithium.
Yeah.
You know?
The majority of the people don't need this fucking thing anyway.
Well, that's a whole nother thing. Yeah. That is a whole nother thing. So it's, I mean, certainly not in a disposable form.
Right.
So that's something that I'd like to nip in the bud. Well, not just me, lots of people, because, you know, it's another thing that, like, it's just ridiculous to have a single-use electronic item. Like, just chuck that headset out after you've used it. That's it. Get a new one. You know, it's just being on your headset. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But it is like, you know what I mean? It's ridiculous.
I've got some other.
So that's something that we're working on now.
Yeah. No, it's horrible. I don't get it myself. And then when I heard that there was disposable vapes, I thought, yeah, no, we're going down the wrong path here. But you can't ban anything outright, because then, yeah, people throw a fit and then they say you're anti-commerce and you're, you know, anti-freedom and stuff like this. But the frivolousness of the modern world is something that this got to change. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it is okay. There's freedom and there's innovation, because you get accused of quashing innovation as a scientist who's often sort of campaigning for different things. I get accused of being anti-innovation and things like that. And it's not. I'm anti-innovation when it's something that is not properly tested for its impacts on the environment, on humans, on everything, and is just kind of unregulated. You know, these unregulated markets. I'm anti that. You know, if you're testing things properly and they're not going to be harmful, then yeah, great. But you know, let's try to be more sustainable.
Yeah. And so, and even you work in science. Have you noticed even science being corrupted by, you know, private companies and stuff like this, like big money, you know, coming in trying to, I've seen this with other academics. In your field specifically, are there shills and stuff like this? Fake science?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is, like, I can't kind of name anything specifically because it's a bit, but there are certain published papers, so academic papers, that sometimes if you look at the author contributions and that, you'll see that some of the authors have links and funding from big oil and stuff like that. And there were papers that came out in the plastics kind of topic that were saying, you know, basically kind of saying that the issue is not that bad. You know, it's not that big an issue. And then you have a look at the authors, and some of them were funded or used to work for some of the big oil companies. Now, luckily, those papers, we were onto it as a group, an international group, we were onto it. Luckily, those papers didn't seem to kind of get, you know, taken up by the media too much and that sort of thing. And they weren't taken that seriously. So it's kind of, okay, that's fine. But, you know, that could potentially be very bad if you've got a massive conflict of interest, basically.
Yeah.
I think it happens. Yeah. And there's a fine line between some of the industry, some industry science is really, really good and robust, and some of it's not. So it's kind of, you've got to really nitpick and see. How do you kind of look behind the scenes?
Yeah, like how do you tell? You go down and you scroll, and they, you hopefully they have that conflict of interest little section in their thing.
That can sometimes do it, but sometimes that's not filled in. If you have a look at the, sometimes you got to look people up and see, you know, actually look them up individually, look up every author and see their previous links.
There was a guy. Yeah. There was a guy that had this study that said ice cream is good for you. It's good for you. It's good for your heart, and it's good for your diabetes. And I looked into it. I had to go through the whole thing. No conflict of interest. But the dude was working for Frito-Lay for like 10 years. He is a corporate scientist, and there's no way in hell that ice cream is good for diabetes. There's just not. And so,
I mean, I wish it was because I love ice cream, but. But yeah, probably not. Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. When they say gin, though, that really hurts. When they say, oh, alcohol is really bad. Yeah.
There must be some benefits.
There's got to be. Yeah. So what's next for you? You're going to be doing any kind of important, exciting, you know, research in the future? What's next for Dr. Danielle Green?
So at the moment, the vape stuff is what we're working on at the moment. I'm hoping that I don't have to work on that for very long, because I'm really hoping we can ban these disposable vapes and it won't be a big issue. It's not going to be a big litter issue, because at the moment they're just kind of at the start of emerging as a litter item, really. I want to stop them becoming a prevalent litter item. So we're focusing on that quite a lot. We've still got a lot of research on cigarette butts as well. So that's another one, which is, you know, the most common litter item in the world, but people don't really think of it as litter because we're so ingrained from watching TV where people go like that and they flick the cigarette away. But, you know, the cigarette filters are plastic. And I think a lot of people don't realize that they actually are plastic. They're single-use plastics again, and they're not readily biodegradable and all that kind of thing. So that's something we're working on at the moment. And then we've got other microplastics research as well at the moment. So, yeah.
Now I'm mad because I see it in my neighborhood. I live in the, like, near the forest, and I go to the forest and I think, oh yeah, anyway, so maybe it's paper. No, cigarette butts are plastic.
Most of them are, yeah. I mean, if you're rolling your own, you might not use a filter, I guess. But yeah, the majority, like 90% or something like that, are made of cellulose acetate, which is a type of plastic, and it doesn't biodegrade quickly. It turns into microplastics too, by the way. So that's another contributor to microplastics, which we think is a major contributor, but it's difficult to prove. When you find a microplastic fiber, it's difficult to say exactly where that came from. So it's, it's one of those things we get in there.
And people that roll your own cigarettes versus vaping, it's hilarious to think that these people are way more green when they roll their own cigarettes, but they are. And that's crazy to me. But also the fact that they're killing themselves also means they're like slightly more green. You know, what do they say? Genghis Khan was one of the biggest environmentalists ever because he wiped out all these people and just let all the forests of Eurasia came back, you know, instantly.
I haven't heard that one. I guess that's quite a unique perspective.
That's just misanthrope humor, like for me. I just love it. Yeah. People will say, oh, they're Malthusian. No, I'm just having fun. Well, Dr. Danielle Green, come back anytime and keep us updated on what's happening in the environment, because it's super important to me and everybody else. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, thanks very much. Really nice to meet you.
Yeah.
And yeah, interesting show. Where can I listen to it? Let me know later.
I will. We'll talk right after this, and I'll give you a link and everything like that. Dr. Danielle Green, Anglia Ruskin University, ecologist, professor, wonderful human being. We'll see you next time.
Thank you very much. See you next time.
Bye, everybody.